Deezer Originals.
Now, it's time for Strong and Stable.
Strong and Stable, 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 Strong and Stable.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Strong and Stable. Yes, like the Great British Bake Off, Strictly Come Dancing and White Supremacists, we're back. It's now September and the summer is already a thing of the past, much like the election and Arsenal's title hopes. And on the subject of football, many of us laughed at PSG as they spent £200 million on Neymar, when for that money they could have bought two DUP MPs. Now let's go and introduce our guests. Firstly, Ian Dunt. He's the editor of politics.co.uk, author of the book Brexit, What the Hell Happens Now, and host of the podcast Romaniacs. A Romaniac, of course, is someone who opposes Brexit, and it's interesting that he implies a mad person, a maniac, unlike, say, someone who believes that after Brexit the NHS will get an extra £350 million a week, which is totally sane! Oh, dear. Gráinne Maguire is an award-winning stand-up writer and actor. Just to be clear, Gráinne is from the Republic of Ireland, not Northern Ireland, and if you find it hard to remember the difference between the two, one has had its future thrown into turmoil by the post-Brexit prospect of a hard border, and so's the other one. And finally, Dan Hodges. Dan is a commentator for the Mail on Sunday, and I can't say that without singing the Craig David song, Mail on Sunday. I can never do it. When his prediction about UKIP's performance in the 2015 general election proved inaccurate, Dan famously ran down Whitehall in just his underpants. Thankfully, we don't have any information as to whether he swung to the right or the left. I'm sorry. I rejected some even worse jokes for that one.
Thank God.
So what was that? What was that about? You had to streak, you said?
I had to streak naked down Whitehall. And in fact, that was one of the times when I actually... That was one of my better predictions. So I actually got the general election right, okay. But just the UKIP vote share wrong.
OK, because you do have a history, which is obviously why we've invited you here as an expert, of getting predictions wrong.
Absolutely. Right. I'm so glad I didn't pledge to streak before this election. I wouldn't have had any clothes on for a year.
What are some of your highlights of bad predictions?
You name them. I think probably my prediction of Theresa May's 100-strong majority on the eve of poll was probably one of the highlights. I think that was probably up there.
Anything... It wasn't you who went on the walking tour to Wales with her and said...
come on, Theresa, go for it.
Brilliant. Oh, well, anyway, welcome, dear guests. Let's start with Brexit, and the negotiations have been making significant progress over the summer, if by significant progress you mean agreeing on which type of biscuits to serve. Yes, the talks have hit trouble quicker than Melania's hand retreating from Donald's touch. The latest news is that Theresa May is going to make a speech in Florence, and if the headline the next day isn't Florence and the Machine, then we've failed as a nation. Ian, if I can start with you as a Brexit expert, is Brexit the biggest mistake since the Nobel Prize Committee said that Aung San Suu Kyi's a nice lady, let's give her a peace prize? How do you think it's going?
It's not going very well. In fact, it looks like a complete shambles. And most of this stuff isn't really the outcome itself. I mean, you could probably do Brexit in a relatively sensible way, as long as you said to yourself, we're going to give ourselves a realistic time frame. If you took like maybe 7 to 10 years, if you really thought we're going to bulk up negotiating capacity, if you came up with some realistic objectives of what you were trying to achieve and how you were trying to do it, you could do this thing. It is possible. It's not the thing itself. It's the manner in which they're doing it. What they've done for the last year and a half is just get lost in this infantile game where they're just, you know, just squalling about what they want, what they want, what they want, not talking about what their negotiating partner wants. And coming up with these almost sort of sci-fi plans. I mean, the customs position paper is the absolute pinnacle of this. I know that you're obviously desperate for me to use words like customs position paper because it brings in so many listeners.
Did you see? Yeah, exactly. Hello to all customs position papers fans out there.
They're queuing outside the door. But nevertheless, I mean, the stuff that they're putting in these things, it is proper sci-fi Mickey Mouse nonsense of the highest order. I mean, what they're talking about is, they're basically talking about tracking every product that comes into Britain to find out where it gets sold. Every banana, every pen, every chair. It is just utter nonsense. And so now, shock of all shocks, turns out it's not working out particularly well when you just start screaming that you want all the things in the world.
That's a great, exciting start for us there. I mean, what's that? Gráinne, how's it? I mean, you're Irish without being that, oh, you're Irish, so you've got to talk about Ireland, don't talk about anything else. But, I mean, the Irish border is like, that's the thing when I confess, sort of full disclosure, I am a Ramona, whenever I'm engaging in a polite manner with Brexiters on Twitter, I always say, what's your solution to the Irish border? And then they just watch them flail. So how's it looking from Ireland?
So don't worry, I have a solution of what we do with the Irish border.
Such a such
are you listening, Theresa May?
Yeah, yeah.
So what we should do is everybody who voted for Brexit should be made do a tour of duty working the Irish border.
Okay.
So it's just like 6 months, a little checkpoint.
Oh, yes, that's nice.
There'll be basic training.
Right.
You know, yeah. They'll get like, you know, maybe, I don't know whether there'll be, you know, guns involved, but, you know.
Okay, I can see problems there, especially when you say guns, and that's, but it is actually a better solution than many that have been.
Get your little letter in the post going,
I'm
off.
Jury service.
Yeah.
Yeah, border service.
Yeah, I'm off to doing a tour of South Armagh for the next 6 months.
Well, maybe we don't tell them what they have to do. There's no training, and we just say, listen, you voted for this, here's your 2 weeks, go and sort it out. And I don't know, Dan, have you got a solution to the Irish border issue?
No, I'm not sure sending a group of hardcore Brexiteers to the Irish border counties is necessarily would be top of my list for a variety of reasons. But no, I don't. And actually, I mean, we're joking. I mean, if you speak to ministers privately, they do actually say that what I think we can now call the Irish question is actually one of the big problems for them.
Irish question used to be, how do I get these bloody U2 albums off of my iTunes?
They are actually very, very concerned about it. I mean, I think more broadly, I thought, you know.
But what could they do about it? What are they planning to do?
Well, that's why they're concerned about it, because they haven't got a solution. No. I mean, that isn't. And I think part of the problem is, I mean, this was a major issue. It didn't come up in the referendum, certainly on the mainland, if I can sort of use that phrase, because I don't think people actually understand the significance of the border issue and the border control issue to the broader peace process, and in particular, obviously, the relevance of that to the nationalist community in Ireland. And that's why ministers are very concerned about it. Now, in terms of the broader sort of thrust on Brexit, and I do sense we don't have a lot of hardcore Brexiteers around this table this morning, so I will try to play the role of devil's advocate, especially given that Ian sat on the fence in such a passionate way there. I mean, I do think Ian's right in terms of the narrative and the perception of Brexit. There is a perception that certainly that's developed over the summer that the thing is a shambles. What I would say is, if you think about the dire predictions of what a Brexit vote would mean, and I remember those dire predictions because I made a lot of them in my column, a lot of people were saying that the moment we voted for Brexit, the British economy would go off a cliff, there would be hell and damnation would come sweeping upon our heads. And the reality is that hasn't happened yet. Similarly, in terms of the concerns about the negotiations, it's absolutely the case that there is a perception that a lot of the progress hasn't been made. But we are still at the start of this process. And the nature of negotiations is people on opposite side of those negotiations don't tend to start off by saying, right, OK, we've got total agreement, you can have this, I'll have that, off we go. You know, this is going to be an extended process, not least because I think part of the problem is our European partners, some would say legitimately, do seem to be intent on using this process to teach us a bit of a lesson.
Mm.
But do you blame them? I wouldn't.
No, like, I don't blame them. In one sense, I don't blame them, because if you look at the nature of the rhetoric that has been directed at them, not just over the course of the referendum campaign, but you could say over the entire course of our participation in the European project, we have not exactly been the best neighbours. But I equally think the idea that Britain now needs to be the subject of a punishment beating to send a message to anybody else within the European Union who may be thinking of going down a similar path do so at your peril.
Gronage, you want to just...
I think that is potentially counterproductive.
It's like our punishment beatings, hello.
Yeah. Ireland, punishment meetings, yes, yes.
You can't help yourself, can you? You can't help yourself.
Pavlovian hosting, yeah, yeah. But you defend the EU.
Yeah, I just think why Britain didn't vote with its head, Britain didn't vote economically when it voted for Brexit, it voted emotionally and it voted politically. So why shouldn't the EU do the same? Britain, it's the weird thing about Brexit, the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, I remember watching that thinking, yes, that's the UK that I love. I've lived here for 10 years. Yes. And my parents are from the generation that they always view British people as arrogant and condescending. And then I was like, no, this is what Britain is like now. And I feel like in the last 18 months, my parents' Britain has reared its head and it's arrogant and it's condescending. And if EU is what it takes to humble us, I'm sorry, guys, it could be for your own good.
This is all Britain's... Sorry, you know, I come to you remember, but just interesting that Brexit really is about you working through stuff with your parents,
yeah,
isn't it?
Basically,
yeah. I mean, look, I just don't sign up to this idea that they're trying to punish us at all. Look, this is how the single market operates, all right? It meshes economies together so that you can trade with one another as if you're the same country. That's how that works. It means you can send goods over because you've got the same standards. So you've got, let's say, the same recycling standards on the way that you do packaging. Or let's say that, you know, the way that a car works in terms of electrically doesn't interfere with pacemakers. So it means that you don't need to check it on your border for the way that it goes across. That is how the single market works. That's why trade works in the single market. Now, we've said we don't want to stick by your standards. We don't want to sign up to your rules, but we still want all the goods to be able to cross over without anything. For them to say, no, mate, you can't do that because that doesn't make any fucking sense, is not an act of punishment. That is just them saying, this is how the system operates. So it's up to us, if we are not going to properly comprehend the manner in which trade works, the manner in which economics works, the interests of other partners, then we are our own punishment mechanism. It is not them doing that to us. It is us doing it to ourselves.
Well, I mean, and I'm sure there are a lot of people that agree with that point of view, but my concern about this argument is this argument is, in a sense, playing into the Brexiteers' hands. The Brexiteers are the ones that have always portrayed our relationship with the EU as one of being a subservient relationship. It's the Brexiteers who has always portrayed it as being actually a malign relationship. These people aren't our friends. They're not even really our partners. They secretly hate us. And the nature of some of the rhetoric, the idea that there have not been some sort of relatively aggressive and helpful statements from the European side of the negotiation front, well, I think would be slightly...
Like what? What is the rhetoric that the Europeans have used against us that has been so pernicious? I mean, what Juncker said the other day was that, you know, Britain is about to realise that it's going to have a hard time outside of the single market, which is demonstrably true. What Michel Barnier said the other day is that Britain was about to be educated about the advantages of the single market,
Juncker stands up and does speeches and says, well, I'd normally be speaking in English, but we don't need to bother with that because the English are completely irrelevant now.
Well, it's really funny, but if the only English-speaking country leaves the EU, then they may not feel the need to keep on talking in that language.
Don't let's not forget Ireland.
I speak, and my brain speaks in Irish, so it's fine. I think it feels like the EU has been like Britain has used it to blame for everything. Everything that's wrong in the country, it's EU's fault, EU's fault. And I think in the next few years, Britain is about to realise the calls have been coming from inside the house the whole time.
Exactly.
And that will be when things get interesting. Mm.
Yes, I mean, the thing that gets me is an interesting point that you're making about how things aren't as bad as Project Fear said they would be. And that always amuses me because, first of all, we haven't left. And secondly, it's like saying, well, Project Fear said we'd lose four limbs. I've lost both arms at the moment and I'm running towards a combine harvester. That's the sort of thing that's happening. I mean, Ian, is there any positive, what can we do now if David Davis came to you and said, listen, I know it's obvious, but I don't know what the hell to do now, what would you suggest?
And he may well do that.
I've been waiting for some time now. Look, he needs to buy himself time. This is the core thing. The main thing that we suffer from is time. So the first thing, of course, is to talk about transition. And ultimately, when we're thinking about where we're going to end up, it is not completely nuts for someone to go, we could have our own bespoke EEA agreement. Like the Norwegians, the Icelandish, the Liechtenstein, they have this sort of basic deal. We're pretty much in the single market. We accept all of the single market stuff on the areas where we share. we care a lot about fish, so we're not going to deal with you guys on fish. We're not going to deal on agriculture. Now, Britain, you know, cares about other things a bit more than that, although politically fish has a disproportionate influence on the way that we do things, even if it doesn't economically. So in the end point, we could say, look, we are going to sign up to these single market rules on this aspect. We are going to say on this stuff, we want to be independent. And that's where we want to get to in about 7 years' time. How can we make this negotiation work? But for us to do that, we have to be realistic. Okay, and that means, yes, you have to accept freedom of movement. You have to accept the rules of the market if that's how you're going to trade. And if we're going to keep on having this demented, hysterical approach towards immigration, we are going to make ourselves poorer. There is no way of getting over that balance. You can have one thing or the other. We can take the country right back to the 1950s. Everyone can look the same. Boiled cabbage for dinner every night, no more curry, and no more funny languages on the train, fine, but you're going to be poorer. So if that's what you really want, that's the price. The other way is to say we can be an open country, we can make this work in a bespoke, some kind of eventual bespoke arrangement with the EU, but sensible objectives and some kind of openness to immigration, because without it, we're doomed.
Dan, I see you want to come in on the boiled cabbage.
I'm here to defend boiled cabbage. No, but I think that's the key thing. I mean, because Ian says we have to be realistic, and I think this is the area where the Remainers, with respect, are not being realistic, because the Remainers are still clinging to this fantasy that there is some way that we can have some sort of we can in some way honour the Brexit result, whilst simultaneously remaining within the single market and retaining freedom of movement. And, you know, you said about this, you know, this toxic immigration debate that we're having. You know, frankly, I now pine for the days of a toxic immigration debate in this country, because we're not having a debate. The debate's over, and progressives like me, and I think you, have lost this debate. So, and you can see it. You can see it in the situation where we had a situation last week where there was this huge leak of the government's immigration proposals, and Jeremy Corbyn, who I'm told on a daily basis is a bastion of progressive values in this country, didn't even mention it. Why didn't he mention it? Because he knows he can't mention it politically, because he knows the argument has been lost, and that if he tried to get the Labour Party to sign up to a retention and a defence of free movement, He wouldn't be able to do so. Now, if the Labour Party isn't able to defend this position, obviously the Conservative Party isn't going to defend it, and that is the circle that can't be squared.
That is such a profoundly fatalistic attitude to have. And Dan, for years you were so good on this. You sat there in the Mail, right where that message needed to be most heard. With people like me, you know, with all of my metropolitan bullshit, we never have a chance of getting hold of that audience. You made the case again and again, and it's all comers. Now, if your position is now, we have fundamentally lost this, there's no chance, there's no point even trying to argue for it. All that is giving up on immigrants in this country who deserve to be represented out there, and to not have their names dragged through the mud as if there's some kind of problem, rather than a contribution to the country. Giving up on the quality of the life of the people in this country. If you're saying that we're not going to be in the single market, we will all be poorer, and the poorest people in this country, those in manufacturing, those in agriculture, they will be the poorest of all of us. The bankers will be absolutely fine.
So I want to move us on, but just to say that the Brexiters didn't give up for 40 years. And if they'd have said, well, the argument's been won, then you know, that we shouldn't say the same about immigration. And I've just abused my power just to say, well, I'm going to say something. and then I decide we'll move on. So there you are. But I was sort of move on to what, just picking up on your talking about Labour, if we could just a moment before we move on from Brexit and how they're... Well, for me, they're sort of going for us like a Schrodinger's Brexit, where you're both in and out. You don't know where you are until you, like, open the box and see. I mean, Gráinne, do you find the Labour position frustrating?
I am on Brexit.
Yeah.
Keir Starmer seems, he seems really intelligent, and I trust him. But, you know, Labour's in a difficult position, because the Conservatives can just be like, we're Brexiteers, but Labour does span a much wider sort of attitude towards it all. So, yeah, I can understand it's that they have to be slightly more new. I wish, obviously, that they were more, and they seem to be becoming more... anti the whole thing. I find that a bit more reassuring.
Because I get the impression that you're sort of perhaps like myself, basically a Remainer who just wants, I just want them to just please be the party of Remain, which I understand, and especially because of the election, I can see how their decision not to just go Remain was a clever one. But Ian, what's your thinking on that?
Look, it has worked out well for them, this kind of sort of constructive ambiguity sort of thing. And then obviously annoys the hell out of people like me, because, you know, he simply lies. I mean, you know, well, He lies or he's stupid. I mean, you can take you...
The blessed Jeremy lies.
Yes. Who would have thought? Who would have thought? The saint from on heaven. But, you know, he comes out the other day. He says, he keeps on saying this thing, you know, quite apart from what we think should happen. He says, you can't be in the single market if you're not a member of the EU. Now, it is objectively, factually false. So he's either lying or he doesn't understand how this stuff works. If he doesn't understand how this stuff works, his failure of responsibility as leader of the opposition at a crucial moment in this country's history is so categoric, so spectacular, that he should be held in disgrace. If he knows what he's doing and he's lying, then fine, but he is really playing the same old Blairite politics that we were so assured his plain-speaking new approach was going to differentiate himself from. I suspect, by the way, that if you look at the people around him, John McDonnell, Seamus Milne, that actually it is a lying thing, that those guys do get it, and that what they're really aiming for is, you know, they're going to get into the transition. At some point, the Tories will be kicked out because the whole thing will just be this absolute churning mechanism that will just mash them up and throw them, spit them out. And then at the end of it, they're going to try and go for the kind of thing I was talking about before, some kind of bespoke EEA thing. They'll get some tinkering stuff on freedom of movement, job offer conditional or something like that, and they'll say it's some great reform that has fundamentally changed. I suspect that's their plan.
Dan, you're a big fan of Jeremy Corbyn, so I'm expecting you to...
actually, on this one, I'm actually going to defend him, and I'm actually going to take my...
Thanks for giving us an exclusive here.
I'm going to take my devil's advocacy up to an entirely new level. Because, I mean, Ian says, you know, he likes... He doesn't lie. Jeremy Corbyn on this has been very clear. He has said, I will respect the result of the referendum. There will be no second referendum. We have to leave the EU. We have to leave the single market. We will not be part of a customs union. And with respect, and you put your finger on it, people like you, David, say, oh, God, I really want Labour to be the party that opposes Brexit. I want Jeremy to be the person that opposes Brexit. And he isn't. But you keep trying to interpret in a way that reinforces your values his position. Mm-hmm. He's been very clear. And you're absolutely right. He did a very good trick in the election. He basically made all the sort of, you know, strong Remainers, he made you all look like mugs. You all went out. You all voted for Labour because Labour was the anti-Brexit party. You woke up the next morning and suddenly thought, saw him on Andrew Marr saying, no, I'm out. And you thought, hang on a second. Mm.
Gronje, how do you feel about... Do you feel mugged off by...
No, because the thing is, if people did this as a protest vote, saying Parliament isn't listening to us, and that's why we're voting, and then if Parliament then turned around and was like, nah, you're a bit thick, you didn't understand it, then, you know, that's not going to solve anything. So, Britain did vote for Brexit. So, I think what Jeremy Corbyn has been saying all along is, OK, Brexit is happening, but let's try and make it the best Brexit. And I think that's just the mature adult response to it all.
Yeah, I mean... for me, I think you're right. And I'm since the election, I've signed back up to Jezza, but I still feel that the Labour attitude to Brexit is a bit like Pinocchio in Shrek 3 when he tries not to answer a question. And I had a sort of that. I went to the Google and had a look at what Pinocchio said. So when Prince Charming asks him where Shrek is, I've rewritten this to be Prince Charming asking Pinocchio what the Labour Brexit plan. It works brilliantly. I think. Well, let me just read. So, Prince Charming, I'll try and do two voices so you can hear. Tell me, what is your Brexit plan? I don't know what it isn't. You're telling me you don't know what your plan is? It wouldn't be inaccurate to assume that I couldn't exactly not say that it is or isn't almost partially incorrect. So you do know what your Brexit plan is? On the contrary, I'm possibly more or less not definitely rejecting the idea that in no way with any amount of uncertainty that I end up... Stop it! Do or do... Anyway, you get the message. To me, Pinocchio is, in Shrek 3, is unfortunately the Labour Party spokesman on Brexit. Anyway, we better move on. Me having got that off my chest, thank you for that indulgence there.
Strong and stable.
This takes us nicely to the EU withdrawal bill, aka the Great Repeal Bill, aka Theresa May's attempt with her Henry VIII powers to take us back not just to 1950, but to 1540, which was the exact time on a Tuesday afternoon she decided to become a power-mad dictator. Let me start with Gronje. I mean, this the Great Repeal Bill. Does this make you uncomfortable?
I just think any bill that's called after Henry VIII is unlikely to be good. Mm. I mean, he hasn't got the best track record. It's just madness. It just seems to be the Conservatives going, oh yeah, don't worry about it. We'll sort it. Don't worry. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. We'll wing it. It'll be brilliant. And just considering the talent that there is in the government right now.
yeah.
It's not the most reassuring.
Yeah. Ian, are you pro-repeal bill?
Oh, as you can imagine, I'm a huge supporter, yeah. Look, I mean, we always knew that they were going to have to use the statutory instrument, things, which is the same as the Henry VIII powers, same as delegated legislation, secretary, whatever. They come up with all of these boring, really arcane language to use on this kind of stuff because they basically want you to look somewhere else. And all the most pernicious stuff in politics basically happens when you start looking somewhere else. That's why these things have such boring names. They're always going to have to use them. There's all these little technical bits. You've got to change, you know, one bit to another bit. You've got to change one bit of wording that says EU into a bit that says UK. And you don't need to have a whole parliamentary debate every time you do it. But it was incumbent on them to put safeguards on these things. They could have allowed for amendments. They could have created committees to evaluate whether they were being used for their proper function. They could have even done something, you know, really radical. They could have like brought in NGOs and trade unions and business leaders to sit on committees to evaluate these things. There were ways of guaranteeing to the public we're not misusing this power. Instead, what did they do? They come out with this bill. You look at sort of, I would look at Clause 7, Clause 8, Clause 9, I think Clause 13, especially Clause 9. I mean, these other clauses basically just allow ministers to do whatever the hell they damn well please. Then you look at Clause 9 and Clause 9. The most startling thing I may have ever seen in a piece of British legislation says, oh, and by the way, we can use these powers on the bill itself as well. So not only do they turn ministers into little mini parliaments, but any safeguards they do put in the bill, they can then undo using the powers they've given themselves using the bill.
That is the astonishing thing. I mean, that bit of the clause that, you know, we can change the old bill. It reminds me of Playground where you say, Bagsy, no returns till infinity, that means you. I mean, that is so... We can't do anything because he's Bagsy'd no returns. I mean, to me, who's often accused of being anti-democratic because I'm a Remainer, the democracy, all these people said, make Parliament sovereign. We must make Parliament sovereign. But actually, we're not Parliament. Let's not do the let's not show Parliament Article 50 bill. Let's make ministers sovereign, which is what this seems to be doing. Let's even objecting to their policies, you're being anti-democratic. I just think, where is democracy? And that's where the tweets that I saw, Dan, actually, because I was banging on about, well, now this committee stage, they're rigging the committee stage. That's anti-democratic. You know,
I have to say, I do think we do need a slight sense of perspective. I mean, firstly, within the it used to be the Great Repeal Bill, the Great Reform Bill. It's now sort of just the reform, plain old run-of-the-mill reform bill. Even within the bill, there are, and there will, I suspect, in committee stage, be built in a series of sunset clauses to save us from the dictatorship.
That's where we're at. We're just going to be slightly saved from utter dictatorship.
Yeah, but I do slightly struggle with this argument that this move is you know, undermining parliamentary democracy, given that the move was actually just this week endorsed by Parliament itself. And I'm also slightly perplexed at this idea that Theresa May is now this Henry VIII figure with this overarching power. There has not been a prime minister in modern political history who has been in a weaker position than Theresa May. And the reality is, if she did do anything especially egregious, Parliament could immediately intercede and she would be out on her ear. So I'm not as emotionally invested in this moment as some others, I've got to be honest.
Ian's leaning right forward. He's practically kissing you, Dan.
Yeah, to be fair, it's quite a small room.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
My thing with the sunset clauses is it doesn't specify the date that they start. It says whenever Brexit is. But it doesn't say who gets to say when Brexit is. So, of course, you can set that date at any point you want. And then anyway, even if that wasn't there, again, Clause 9 means you can change all of these rules without any parliamentary debate itself.
Yep.
So there is no safeguard they can put in there which would be remotely tolerable by virtue of the powers contained in the bill.
You were saying before about we need to be realistic. I mean, what major change to the Brexit process do you think ministers could unilaterally, in a practical political sense, could unilaterally impose against the will of the House of Commons, which would mean, by definition, going against the will of a majority of the parliamentary Conservative Party?
It's not going to be like there's going to be a dictatorship. They're not organised enough for like proper evil to take on the street.
They're not that clever.
But it'll just be shit. I just don't trust them. I just don't think they're sophisticated. It'll just be the rubbish option, and then decades' time, people look back and go, what?
Can I move us on a little bit? And just we've mentioned her, which is hardly unsurprising. Theresa May, how's she doing? Is it Gronu? Do you think she's, as she said, and she's a woman who we can trust when it comes to elections. She's going to be there till 2022?
I find Theresa May fascinating. I don't understand how you can get to 60 years of age and only then realise you're not a people person. How is that possible? And I think it's so funny because Tories used to call her mummy in sort of weird way.
Because
they're all creepy people who fancy their nannies. But now I think they call her mummy because she's dead, but she keeps walking.
Again, your parents' problem. I mean, seriously, we should make this 50 minutes of therapy length. And then
I think she's hilarious as a she's like Bridget Jones, but talk about self-sabotage. She's fascinating, and I almost feel sorry for her.
She is basically being kept there as a human shield because the guys that would take over know how punishing the next few months of Brexit are going to be. They know the kind of compromises you're going to have to make, or the repercussions of not making those compromises. And either way, it's bleak. And so they're happy for her to just take all of that damage and then hopefully one of them steps in on the other side. You know, that's what she is right now. And when you look at the government, you know, you can't find any coherent story to tell about it, really. You can't really say what its values are. You can't really say what it wants to do, even on Brexit, which is basically the only thing it's trying to do, full stop. And the reason for that is she has no authority. They're a bunch of cats fighting in a bag, and the only thing they can agree on is that they'd rather it was her taking the punishment than themselves.
Dan? Big fan?
Do you know what, actually, even though I know she's an absolutely appalling and useless politician, on a personal level, I actually agree with you, actually. I actually came out of the election campaign with more personal sympathy for Theresa May. If only I went to this event, I think it was a campaign, early in the campaign in Bristol, and it was in this small community hall, and obviously all ordinary people had been thrown out, and a small group of Tory activists had been bussed in. So there were about 60 or 70 people in the hall. Very small audience, relatively small press pack. And she came in to speak to them. And if you look at her up close, like her hand shakes and the voice trembles. And she's got this affectation where just before she starts speaking, she does the sort of like the May pause where she'll literally stop and you think, she's not going to be able to get through this, and then she starts talking. You see, you're all laughing at the poor woman. And I actually thought, going through these things, going through the, as you said, you know, the process of meeting ordinary people, campaigning, all this sort of stuff, and there's all this sort of stuff which she loves. You know, people around her saying she loves campaigning. You know, it is a physical torture for this woman to get through it.
What career advisor said to her?
Exactly.
So you, because you hate people or you hate being around people,
and
you should be
positive. The fact that she somehow has managed to get through all this and get to a national leadership position is incredible, but the reality is she's gone. I mean, in 18 months she'll be gone.
Is she like the Tory Gordon Brown, do you think?
No, because Gordon Brown didn't have, I mean, Gordon Brown had his faults, but he didn't have the same physical discomfort. You know, he could give a speech, he could address people without it being a physical chore for him. I mean, on a personal level, you know.
But he was sort of tidying up Tony Blair's mess as well. They should be friends.
They should.
Partnership programme between them. He should, you know, he could be like her Obi-Wan Kenobi arriving.
Wow. Yeah. I'd watch that sitcom. Yeah.
I just want to say, because I don't know if you're aware of this, speaking as an EU person, just how hilarious the other EU countries are finding Brexit. I don't think, because it's so funny. It's so funny. And like, because I own an Irish passport, so it's like I feel conflicted between like my sympathy for British people in Britain and just my absolute love of drama. So it's a difficult time for me, but it's so funny, guys.
Carry on. It's going to run and run.
Just to be clear, it's going to destroy your economy too. I just want to put that on the table.
No hard feelings.
But as long as you guys are humiliated, Irish people will take it.
Fair enough. What do they think about the border out there, just to get back to the border?
I mean, they've taken, most Irish people see it just as a symbol of just British arrogance and ignorance. Like, so many of my friends completely like thought the DUP were just created about 6 months ago. Mm. Like no knowledge of the Northern Irish peace process, the Good Friday Agreement, stuff that like Irish people just grow up watching on the news. That there's no knowledge about on the news here, or even like it's not even taught at schools. And I just think that's what's happening. Just British people are just ignorant about what this political situation in Northern Ireland is.
Sorry about that. I'm awfully sorry.
Whoever you are.
Yes. Awfully sorry, Irish person.
It's Strong and Stable.
OK, this week the government announced pay rises for police and prison officers, so at least when all the other public sector workers riot because they're not getting one, there's an outside chance there'll be someone there to lock them up. Here's roving reporter Jonathan Pye on this very subject.
With the pay freeze lifted for police and prison services and with a successful Labour amendment to include NHS workers, many are calling this the beginning of the end of austerity. OK, well, that backfired, didn't it? Let's do something that will be generally welcomed and is bound to make us more popular, bit like the election. Let's give police officers a pay rise of 1%. Yeah, I'm sure they're jumping for joy, Theresa. Crack open the special brew, lads. Police officers are earning on average 15% less than they were 7 years ago, so a 1% pay rise. It's not so much strong and stable as just stingy. All this pay rise in massive inverted commas has done is remind us all that there was a public sector pay cap in the first place. She just reminded us of the Tories' apparent disdain for the people who do the most stressful and important work in our country. Because obviously we don't want nurses to be paid properly, do we? Firemen? Fuck them. Teachers? What the fuck have they ever done for us? No. Give them a bigger workload and less pay. Don't give the public sector a pay rise for 7 years and for most still counting. That'll teach those teachers for being so fucking virtuous with their goddamn teaching. And the thing is, for those lucky enough to get it, it isn't even a pay rise. Prison officers are getting a 1.7% pay rise on the same day inflation hits 2.9%. The idea that anyone is going to buy the idea that this is anything but a pay cut is ridiculous. For starters, prison and police officers will be able to tell it's not a pay rise, largely thanks to the small but nonetheless significant clue that they've got less fucking money. And here's the best bit. Where's the money coming from? Answer, nowhere. No extra money to pay for it whatsoever. Not a fucking penny. You'll take this 1% pay rise from your existing budget, the same budget that we've been slashing for years. You'll probably have to lay a few people off, but hey, pay rise! And people are calling this the end of austerity. Bullshit. Yes, I'm ready. Yeah. Well, it's been another week of turmoil between us and the EU.
Big thanks there to Jonathan Pye.
Strong and stable.
Let's talk about Labour a little bit more. Ever since Labour won the election, in the same way that I won Miss World in 1988, it seems that the love-in continues and we're all Corbynites now. Well, almost all. I'll come to you in a moment, Dan. I can feel you straining at the leash. Kezia Dugdale resigned, saying it was time to pass on the baton, possibly so Corbyn supporters could hit someone else with it. I have to do this. I have to be balanced, but it's not easy for me. Dan, you're a massive Corbyn fan. Always have been. Your man has really, really pulled it off, eh?
Yeah, he has. I think he's. I sometimes think he does it just personally annoy me. The one good thing I personally cling to after the disaster for me of the election result is since the election, just about everything Jeremy Corbyn has done has been the wrong thing. So I take some comfort in that. I mean, he had the opportunity to really sort of to reach out to the moderates in the party and bring them into the fold, and he hasn't done that. He said, "Screw you! I'm just going to keep hammering you," and his supporters are going to keep hammering him. He embarked on, you know, his victory tour around the country and his victory rally at Glastonbury, and I don't think the British people really like politicians who sort of self-aggrandise in quite that way.
But to get back to the election, because I came off the Corbyn...
Do we have to go back to
that thing that you got hopelessly wrong?
Do we have to mention that?
I also confess, got off the Corbyn bandwagon about 3 months four.
Oh, but you've come crawling back. No,
I have come crawling back.
Oh, yeah,
because
yeah.
My worry was he was unelect. All this stuff for me is unelectable. He's, you know, he wouldn't start winning Scotland back. He wouldn't appeal to the young. Wouldn't come out. He proved me absolutely wrong. And do you not feel? Oh well, actually, because you're somewhere in you as a Labour man.
No, absolutely.
Well, Dan, why are you criticising him for carry on doing the exact same things that resulted in an election that everybody said was impossible? Well, like, that's it worked.
Hope. Hope in my case. No, I mean, I think...
But do you still think he's unelectable and bad? And...
No, I think there was, where I would say just slight defence of myself, I think my criticism of Jeremy Corbyn was twofold. One, I thought he'd be a political disaster. But two, I hoped he'd be a political disaster because I was terrified of what would happen if he won the election. And actually, in fairness, which is why I did actually vote Conservative for the first time. In my life, and I am slightly concerned. I mean, obviously, you know, it was in relative terms, a much better result than people expected. As you pointed out, not quite the victory that some people actually thought. But for me, it doesn't change the fundamentals. It doesn't change the fundamental flaws in terms of his economic policy. It doesn't change the fundamental flaws in terms of his foreign policy. It doesn't change the fundamental flaws around the nature of Corbynism, how its politics is constructed. The anti-Semitism within the Labour Party hasn't suddenly been magicked away by the election result, and all those things still stand. So,
Just bring in Gráinne? I mean, how do you feel about Jeremy? Are you
It's quite similar opinion to yours. I thought his ideas were all wonderful and brilliant, but I just thought, oh, yeah, it's not electable, it's not practical, and I thought he had surrounded. I liked his ideas and I liked his personality, but I thought maybe the people around him were not the best. So that's why I was very surprised by the election result. And I just thought he earned the right to sort of lead the party the way that he wants to. And I prefer when Labour is sort of a broader church and when everybody's brought in and, you know, that all the different voices are listened to. But I definitely think after, you know, he got the result that nobody thought was possible, that he deserves a certain amount of respect and to be listened to.
I prefer to combat the accusations of anti-Semitism in Labour. I prefer to refer to Labour as a broader synagogue. Ian, are you a diehard Corbynite?
No, I think he's rubbish.
Despite the election?
Yeah. Look, I mean, he did all right. I think he looks really good. I think the moment for me was when he was on the One Show, and there's a bit where it's hard to cook this up, but, you know, they basically just go, oh, tell us about your allotments. And he just looks like this really nice uncle. And you sort of think, oh, you look all right. And then you switch over and it's Theresa May, and she looks like this malfunctioning monstrosity. And you just think, what of those two options? I'll take the nice uncle, please. So I get that he's good at that. I don't even really get the campaign thing. I mean, I don't think he's particularly great on a speech. I think basically what's happened is that they just want people to be genuine. That is the core quality that people want in the politician right now. And he provides that because he can only be himself. However, campaigning is not the entirety of what a leader of the opposition does or what a prime minister should do. Part of it is holding the government to account. I don't want to be old-fashioned about this, but it does sort of matter to me that he holds the government to account. And I don't want to crack on back into the Brexit thing, but there is no other government policy, so there's nothing else for us to really talk about there. That is the main thing that is happening. It is, whichever your view on it, the most significant change that this country will experience since the war. He will not talk about it. He hasn't talked about it in the last PMQs. He hasn't talked about it in the PMQs before that. He avoids it at all costs. He is an absolute vacuum on basically the entirety of the business of government. So on that basis, I'm sorry. I mean, I get, you know, again, he did better than I thought. And I'm glad it worked out that way. I'm glad young are involved in politics. I'm glad that it was seen that you could have a transactional policy relationship with the young of saying, well, look on tuition fees, because it means that the young's economic interests will be better represented than they have been over the last few years. But if you ask me, is this guy a good leader of the opposition? Is he the kind of guy you'd want running the opposition during this period? My answer has to be no.
Just to remind everyone who's listening that Ian Dunt is Jeremy Corbyn's agent. But are you, as an official young person, are you energised officially by Jeremy?
I don't know.
Doesn't sound like it for those noises you're making.
My gut instinct is Jeremy Corbyn, some of the people who surround him seem to be quite nasty. And not Jeremy Corbyn himself, but some of the people who really, really love Jeremy Corbyn seem to me really awful. Like the people on Twitter and Facebook, and you're just like, ugh. I don't trust anybody who thinks politics is simple and that, you know, that the moral integrity somehow means that you're a brilliant leader. Like, the best politicians are like, yeah, it's a lot more complicated than this. This is the best deal we can do. So that's why I am a bit sceptical about Jeremy Corbyn, because I don't trust anybody who has simple solutions to anything.
You know, that was the great... There's loads of stuff I really don't agree with Macron about, especially on sort of civil liberties. He says some stuff on immigration I don't like. There's loads of stuff to disagree with there. But do you remember in the French election, there was a period where there were these workers outside of the factory and Marine Le Pen went over to talk to them and she just gave them, you know, you can imagine, sort of fascistic, vile horror. And then Macron went... And he refused, cameras are on him, they're basically shouting him. He just refused to give them easy solutions to the problems. He kept on saying, look, there are forces here, there are dynamics, and it's really hard for us to control. I can try to work within it, but I cannot just give you this simple broad brush thing to tell you everything's going to be okay, because it won't necessarily. What I can tell you is I will work to find those bits. And I took, just for that alone, for the level at which debate was being set of recognising complexity, he deserved full credit for that in a way that Jeremy Corbyn doesn't, and in a way that obviously, you know, Nigel Farage and the others on the right, including the right in government, do not.
Well, I'd just like to restore a little bit of balance and say that I think the manifesto was fantastic. Mm-hmm. It wasn't simple. It had it was costed. It was inspiring. I thought Jeremy was inspiring to even to old hag like me. And on election day, I always go and get out the vote. And I went to this constituency that, you know, I've been to before to get out the vote. And I couldn't get into the room, the flat where not just the room, the flat where you go and register, because there were so many young people. And that for me was exciting. It's my podcast. I'll have the last word.
This is Strong and Stable.
Just before we wrap up, I've got a little quiz for you. It's Who Said It this week. So let's start with you, Dan. Who said this about whom? I'm not quite sure what the point of his interview was, actually.
I haven't got a clue.
I should throw it open to the house for a bonus point. Right. I'm not quite sure what the point of his interview was.
I'm presuming it was a... Maybe I'd go with Vince Cable talking about Jeremy Corbyn on The World at One.
No, you're one step removed. It was Jeremy Corbyn talking about Tony Blair's appearance on Mars. Tony Blair met the Pope this week, or as Tony Blair calls him, a weapon of mass. His Holiness thought the meeting went well, and so did the Pope. Right.
Do you think? I bet in Tony Blair's house, he's got a scale model of Number 10. In his house.
Do you think?
And he just lives there.
Yes.
And nobody's broken it to him that he's not Prime Minister anymore. Yeah. He's just happy.
And waging wars and what have you. Yes, I think you're probably right. So, okay. Well, Gráinne, try this one. Who said this and who was it aimed at? Men who don't change nappies are deadbeat dads.
Is that Ian Duncan Smith on the new policy on who gets child benefit, that if you're not good at changing nappies, you're out?
I mean, there's wrong and there's like leave the
thank
podcast
you
now.
It's someone talking about Jacob Rees-Mogg, isn't it?
Yes, I'm sorry, I'm afraid, Gráinne, that's right. It's half right.
I'd say maybe Jess Phillips.
I think Dan knows.
It was Harriet Harman.
Huh.
Excellent. It was Harriet Harman talking about Jacob Rees-Mogg, who famously doesn't change his nappies. Not his nappies, that would be. I don't know. Latin scholar Jacob Rees-Mogg denies he's hopelessly out of touch with modern culture, and there's nothing he likes more than sitting down on a Saturday night, switching on the TV and watching The Ten Factor. Okay. Thanks for that, Gráinne. Ian, right, here's yours. Your quote. Jeffrey Boycott has still got my Tupperware.
Oh, Theresa May. On Test Match Special.
Very, very good. Very good. Nailed it.
I thought that was from Hillary Clinton's new book.
Jeffrey Boycott. Wow.
That
was the title, wasn't it?
Like, I mean, you were great
Jeffrey,
with the sort of...
got my Tupperware.
Theresa May and Gordon Brown was a great sitcom, but to see Jeffrey Boycott and Hillary Clinton, that... amazing. So Theresa May and Jeffrey Boycott don't have much in common. One has a reputation for being disliked by teammates and stubbornly hanging around despite being boring. You see where I'm going with this? And the other is a former cricketer. You were there before me. Well, that's it from us. I'd like to thank our brilliant guests, Ian Dunt, Gráinne Maguire and Dan Hodges, our special correspondent, Jonathan Pye, and our writers, Andrea Mann, Robin Flavel, Dan Bowman and Andrew Doyle. Watch or indeed listen out for a special bonus Extra Strong and Extra Stable podcast gem coming on Monday, exclusively on Deezer. And don't forget to comment on iTunes if that's where you're listening, and like and retweet and all that on your socials. We'll be back quicker than Ted Cruz can delete his internet history. In other words, next Friday. See you then and goodbye.
That was Strong and Stable. We'll catch you next time. Please subscribe.
Deezer. Originals.